and I thought the chef's name was Savoy, as in Savoy cabbage. Makes the best cabbage rolls. Nah, it's French, Savoie. Good thing I knew that when I went in. Caesar's Palace was a short walk among furiously smoking people from my dump, the Imperial Palace. Entering, I'm surrounded by well-lit sculpture and enough gold to choke a tax collector. Didn't mind waiting in the lobby a few minutes for Guy Savoy to open. Adjust dinner jacket, now fouled with smoke. A costume of coughing. I'm served by two men, one tall, one short. Reminded me of a book I used to read my daughter at night about tall Fred, who was given a short bed in a hotel, while his short friend, Ted, received a bed too long for him.
Read me a story, Tutan.
Which one?
Big Dog, Little Dog.
Okay. Good night, Ted, said Fred. Sleep well. Good night, Fred, said Ted. Sleep well. But they did not sleep well.
Fred thumped and bumped and tossed and turned. Ted moaned and groaned and crashed and thrashed.
I was offered a cart of champagne. Which would I choose? After inquiring about the amuse-bouches, I dismissed the rosés, perhaps prematurely. What I really wanted to say was, which is cheapest? But it seems a ludicrous question in this restaurant. I went with the dry one. Dry is good for me generally. Upon getting my bill later, I discovered the glass cost more than my fish course. But all things chemically considered, it was worth it.
Why are we paying hundreds of dollars for food?
Well, it's supposed to be an adventure.
So is death.
First up, some sort of bread thing with foie gras and truffle. I didn't taste either of them individually, just the bread, but it sort of swam in them. Beautifully augmented by the champagne, I don't recognize this as bread, just some sort of sodden softness. The postage stamp-sized French burger once again alters reality, just as Tommy Keller's artichoke coronet at Per Se a few months ago sent me back to an Italian restaurant in Van Nuys in 1956. This burger transported me to the very first hamburger I ever ate, also Van Nuys, late 1962. I had to re-inhabit my 2011 body. The dislocation, the sudden transport to that distant time was so intense and exhausting, particularly when I have to suddenly come back and talk. Yes, it was very good. I explained that I'd just traveled to a distant era and was told, yes, that's what the food is supposed to do. It isn't just Tommy Keller. A successful taste transports you to where you need to be but could not otherwise get to. An unsuccessful taste merely mires you in the sodden now. The champagne hasn't been on the table long enough to change flavors, but it does, perhaps because of the food. It seems crisper. I kneaded it with a theatrical amuse. The crab reveal at the end had only a crab aftertaste, nothing within the moment to savor. This is becoming a theme. And finally, the black truffle soup. I'd read such extravagant praise of the soup. I thought it was the best thing I'd eat here. It was okay. There was something addictive about it. I kept spooning it into my mouth. Yet I wasn't actually enjoying it all that much. Sometimes an artichoke would make its appearance. Maybe I should have had a wine pairing with this, as the dish clearly needs more of an assist than I'm getting from my ice water. Possibly because the French burger altered reality so severely a few minutes ago, the soup just couldn't keep up. But it was warm. An antidote to all known winters. Maybe the soup exists in a different dimension than flavor. You gotta give the chef some slack when you're paying this much for a bowl of soup. The brioche accompaniment was an interesting texture, but there were already too many textures and not enough interesting flavors.
This is really expensive.
They could feed whole villages for what we're paying for this meal.
A bread cart is wheeled out. Lots of twisted loaves evoke my Ukrainian grandmother's artistic loaves, enough bread in that cart to save villages in Ukraine from starvation under Stalin. He starved my Ukrainian relatives to death in some of the richest land in the world, while I contemplate bread as architecture. I peruse the pretty loaves, and my starved ancestors wail at the lives denied them. I finally select a juniper berry bread. I like berries in general, and their juniperosity in this chunk of bread might well recall the citrusy gin that so inflated my enjoyment of the meal at Mix on Monday. I enjoyed the juniper bread, though it made me wish for another of those great cocktails from Mix. It was insisted that I have some lemon bread with my sea bass. I'm usually on the side of citrus-influenced anything. The multi-level dudes were right. The bread goes wonderfully with the sea bass foam, made from the sea bass itself. The crispy sea bass features skin that I could actually eat. This has never happened before. This is a miracle. It is called sea bass with delicate spices, which turn out to be grains of pepper so precisely targeted to your tastes you could invent mathematics from their trajectory. The pepper was an immense part of the meal, its lingering aftertaste from one dish influencing how I'd react to the next. Not an unusual experience in this level of foodery, but done most exquisitely here. Delicacy, like kindness, is vital. It is a concept upon which civilization depends for our species as much as the parliaments of ourselves. Being delicate, like being kind, can only be beneficent. After I turned down dessert, they brought out two more of those delightful tiny burgers. I remember how my family first began eating meat. In October 1962, I was in seventh grade. I walked home from school at 3:30, and was surprised to see my dad's car sitting in the driveway, with him in it. Normally, he gets home at 5:30.
You're home early, Dad.
We're all gonna die right now, son.
Well, let's go inside with Mom. It's about 10 steps from the car, not very far.
We do not have time.
Time to walk 10 steps? I just walked a mile home from school. I'll try to make it to the front door.
Dad did eventually come inside, and we weren't incinerated by Russian missiles at that moment. What was incinerated was our vegetarianism. My parents were determined to make up for all the dead cows they'd deprived themselves of for decades. It was 3 steaks a day from then on. If the cows have a religion, my parents would be their devils. When I left the restaurant, something very strange happened. Thankfully, I was holding on to the railing at the top of the stairs when a tsunami of pleasure overtook me. As the light we see from the sun is from 8 minutes ago, I seem to have been hit by an overload of my senses brought on by Guy's food 8 minutes after my last bite. The stairs loomed below like Scrooge's staircase in the 1951 movie. If it had happened after I'd taken a step down the stairs, I would have probably lost my grip and fallen to my death. As I was experiencing the earthquake, suddenly there was Jose Andres. He's much younger and larger than I expected.
Have some food,
he told me. Well, no, I just had, by my standards, a large meal. But thanks for the offer. I know of his quest to turn the world onto tapas, so I tell him, my wife and I spent November 2002 traveling around Spain and eating tapas.
You're my man,
he says, and then he hugs me, which is what I would expect the hug from a bear would feel like. I assumed the bear would be more likely saying, you're my dinner. I ate at your Yaleo restaurant in D.C., I tell him. Tapas there were really good.
Have you been to my Vegas Yaleo?
I refrain from the memory of such recent pain. I mean, after all, this is the famous Jose Andres, who does wonderful stuff keeping the almost dead from being the dead, even though most of his Vegas tapas suck. Still, it's great to know I can always rely on the world's central kitchen. What I learned from Jose, more from his mission than his cuisine, food keeps you alive. That's his main goal. Giving you transcendent visions is just dessert.
This is Richard Fish with this afternoon's news this afternoon. In the latest news from Egypt, more worrying to the regime than the angry throngs in Tahrir Square are the strikes that are paralyzing the country. All sectors have gone on strike except the police and the army. Kamal Abbas, a labor leader, said workers, quote, were motivated to strike when they heard about how many billions the Mubarak family was worth. They said, how much longer should we be silent? Egypt is not a stranger to strikes. In Thebes, in 1700 BCE, artisans went on strike after failing to be paid. The workers had waited for 18 days beyond their payday and refused to wait any longer. They lay down their tools and marched toward the city, shouting,
"We are hungry!"
What began as a complaint over late wages turned into an action protesting corruption and injustice. Toward the end of their strikes, the workers were no longer chanting about their hunger, but about the larger issue.
"We have gone on strike not from hunger, but because we have a serious accusation to make."
Sound familiar? In an interview with ABC News, Vice President Suleiman, who has been leading those negotiations with the opposition, warned that protests were very dangerous and ominously said the only alternative to dialogue was a coup. In response, activist and Google executive Wael Ghonim told CNN he had a message Wednesday for his country's leaders.
"If you are true Egyptians, if you are heroic Egyptians, it's time to step down."
Ghonim, who was freed Monday after being held by Egyptian authorities for 12 days, said,
"It is no longer the time to negotiate with the regime of Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak. There's a lot of blood now that has been spilled. It's time for the people at the highest levels of government to apologize to the family of those killed. It's time for people at the highest levels of the government to apologize to the families of those killed. A lot of times, the policemen would stand on the bridge and shoot people down. This is a crime. The president needs to step down because this is a crime."
There is a sense that it is now possible to fight back. People that you would never normally associate with political activism are suddenly rising up in protest. From the Supreme Council of Antiquities to the Animal Research Center, where staff claim their director has been siphoning off money destined for avian influenza programs to buy personal villas in Alexandria. There is a growing sense that something fundamental is shifting in Egypt. People are no longer willing to accept the status quo between themselves and their overlords, be they in the presidential palace or in the boss's office next door. Al Jazeera reports that the Egyptian government has agreed to amend 6 articles of the Constitution immediately. They include the respective articles that restrict who can run for president and allow for unlimited presidential terms. One of the chants one hears in the square is, "We are all one hand," stressing the solidarity of the Egyptian people in revolt. One of the striking things about the gathering in Tahrir Square is that it's multi-generational, and there are as many women as men.
"I'm heading down to the square.
It's dangerous."
"I know.
Not all Egyptian men are gentlemen.
Pharaoh Mubarak hasn't been very gentle with the Egyptian people. We have to change that."
Parents came to Tahrir and asked for forgiveness for a lifetime of moral cowardice, and for their final failed attempt at authoritarianism in the home when they tried to prohibit their young from joining the revolution. Those parents, even more than their children, made a journey of stunning proportions out of the walled gardens of fear in which they had lived their entire lives.
In May 1998, Britt's boyfriend bought her a ticket to Japan. She was 9 when we moved from Japan to Vancouver in 1988, and was 19 now. She had never gone there by herself and had worries.
"I'm worried about being molested on a train in Tokyo."
"Japanese trains are so full of molesters, they have special cars just for women. But what would you do if some man tried to molest you on a Vancouver train?"
"I'd beat him up."
"Do the same thing in Tokyo. You're really strong, Bit." That was our last conversation.